Okay,
Hello.
well.
Oh, good. All right, so we got everyone that we need. So let's go ahead. It's 12:03 p.m. here at the Naturopathic Medical Board meeting. I'm Dr. Bruce Sadlick. And with us today, we have Mr. Casey Hutchinson from the Attorney General's Office. And then our Executive Director is Ms. Gail Anthony. And we'll do roll call. Good, Gail.
Okay. And Dr. Sadlick?
Here.
Dr. Popiel?
Here.
Ms. Gallen?
Here.
Dr. Campbell?
Here.
Dr. Spatt?
Here.
Dr. Brown?
Here.
Mr. Mahler?
Here.
And we have quorum.
All right. I didn't see any conflicts of interest. We're on to number two. And then the board does have on to number three, civility statement. In accordance with the open meeting law, the board has civility policy that prohibits any type of disorderly conduct that disrupts the board from carrying out our business. Those violating this policy will be asked once to modify their behavior and act civilly. If they cannot, then we'll disconnect you. I'd like to move on to number four, consent agenda review, consideration and possible action regarding approval of the following applications. It looks to me, board members, if you agree, we could take 4A and run that all the way through 4S.
This is Dr. Popiel. I second that motion.
And all those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries.
Next, let's move on to number five. Review consideration and possible action regarding the following board cases. We'll start off with 5A, and that would be Dr. Sunil John, case number 24-269. And this is the continuation of the initial interview we've had with him prior. And if Ms. Anthony can give us a little bit of background, that would be helpful.
Sure. And Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, this is case number 24-269. Dr. Sunil Jain, on September 26, 2024, the Naturopathic Physicians Medical Board received a letter self-reporting the arrest of Dr. Jain on September 19, 2024. According to the police report, respondent's vehicle crossed over the double yellow line while driving, almost causing a head-on collision with another vehicle. After stopping the vehicle, officers observed dry blood on respondent's head, and his wife, who was sitting in the passenger seat, had swollen lips, bruising, and dry blood on her. It was noted respondent did become argumentative during the encounter and refused the breathalyzer test on the scene. Respondent was ultimately arrested and the blood testing was performed. The result of the test came back with a blood alcohol level of 0.162. At the meeting of November 14th, 2024, the board reviewed case number 24269. At that meeting, the board ordered an interim psychological evaluation. The board did receive the report dated 1-6-2025. The conclusion and recommendation states in part, quote, there's no clear evidence that Mr. Jain has an active substance use disorder or that he has or is currently abusing any substances. Mr. Jain, his approach to interpersonal relationships, both professional and personal, may be impacted negatively by his sense of high self-importance described in the assessed results. Mr. Jain's behaviors impact his level of self-reflection and awareness. This, however, does not pose a current risk to his ability to safely and skillfully practice medicine.
Thank you, Ms. Anthony. Is Dr. Jain or his legal counsel on?
Yeah, Larry Kazan appearing on behalf of Dr. Jain this afternoon, Your Honor. Or excuse me, sir.
Hi, Mr. Kazan. Do you want to give us any feedback?
Yes, it sounds to me like Dr. Jain has done everything that the board has asked him to do. I think the psychological evaluation is indicative of the fact that maybe we should be able to move on from this. I don't think Ms. Anthony mentioned it, the psychological evaluation did note that ancillary to the psychological evaluation, Dr. Jane went to Sun Valley Recovery, was assessed, and as a result of that assessment, completed 20 hours of alcohol education and treatment. And I provided proof to the board of that completion. It looks like Dr. Jane has done everything that he's been asked to do. It looks like he's on track, and I don't think the board should take any further action against him.
Okay, thank you. Board members, I think we have several options. It's really up to the board to decide. One could be in addition to the 30 hours of CME we have, that we could look at doing through PBI. There's a couple of courses that would be probably relevant. One would be based on civility, and then the other one would be based on ethics. And this would be PBI, and one course is called civility and civility and communication, and then the other one is ethics and professionalism. These could be in addition to his 30. The other thing we could look at is a consent agreement. If anyone thought probation was necessary, that could be in there too. So I'm going to ask the board members which direction they're leaning.
This is Dr. Popiel. I'll just give you quick my thoughts. After reading through, let's see, I guess Dr. Wooten or Buffy Wooten's summary, and just kind of the take on what happened that night, I still have some concerns about how everything went down, the fact that his wife was bloodied, the, I guess in my opinion, refusing to agree to the breathalyzer, being combative, and then even in the conversation with Buffy was kind of a defensiveness about that evening and everything that went down. So it just, I don't love some of the statements, I guess, that have been made, and just, you know, just kind of some of the inconsistencies in the story as to why his wife was bloodied and what happened that night and all. So I don't know if this rises to a level of a consent agreement, but I'm leaning towards that, I guess, at this point.
Okay.
And just with the additional continuing education and the probation as was potentially suggested by the executive director.
Okay. Let me move from Dr. Spatt. Let me get your thoughts on it. You there, Dr. Spatt?
I'm sorry, my was on mute for some reason. Sorry about that. No problem. I have a similar concern to what Dr. Popper was saying, but on the other hand is that I think he went through rehab, so I just give him a benefit of a doubt, and hopefully he learned from his mistake, and hopefully he's not gonna make the same mistake again. Other than that, I will hear what other board member I have to say before I make any decision on it.
Okay. Dr. Campbell, your thoughts?
Thank you. I concur with both of our colleagues who've spoken thus far. Moreover, the behavior and conduct from the time of stop is definitely concerning and violates, you know, the important conduct that professionals hold themselves to. There are a lot of questions that we have, and I feel that he would benefit from the CME that has been, discussed earlier. Also, you know, provided somebody is going to hold themselves accountable and complete probation, it's a kind of a fail-safe for the board to ensure that somebody is as committed as you know, that they maintain that level of commitment and prove to the board that they can complete the training or the CME and then also hold themselves out of trouble in the future. And then we come to a disposition together down the road when the board, you know, allows that probation to come to an end. And so that would probably be the direction that I would like to see the case go. Again, I'd like to hear from our other esteemed board members as to their opinions.
Dr. Brown?
I'm along the same line as what everybody else is. I think actually probation would be appropriate because we need to just continue to keep an eye on it, I think. Otherwise, it's putting the board in a very vulnerable position if another incident was to happen. So I would move towards probation.
Okay. And then Ms. Gallen?
Yeah, I appreciate the work that's kind of been done. But I also do agree that, you know, possibly something like probation would be worth discussing. I have some concerns and, you know, it's just something that to monitor, I think, to make sure that there won't be a future problem because to just assume that there won't be kind of puts us in a problematic situation as a board.
Mm-hmm. And is Mr. Meller on the call?
Yes, I'm here. I do have a quick question for Mr. Kazan, if I'm not sure if you know the answer to this, but has he made any personal decisions on the future use of alcohol? Has he quit?
I don't believe that Dr. Jane has done anything regarding alcohol since he's completed his treatment. I think Dr. Jane has recognized what perilous circumstances he put the public in by his behavior. And I think that has been extremely troubling to him. He's lived out more than half of his life at this point in time without ever having been in any kind of trouble before. And having had, just in terms of the criminal charge against him, having had to go to the treatment that he's completed and actually spend time inside of a jail cell has been, this has all been very eye-opening for Dr. Jane, and I believe very troubling for him. I think that the psychological evaluation didn't really point to anything regarding any kind of problem with alcohol. It strikes me that Dr. Jane is capable of making all the right decisions. He's made, and don't get me wrong, I appreciate all of the board's concerns about the post-arrest or post-stop behavior. But in my experience, I have found that people at that kind of blood alcohol level, if they're not used to that kind of blood alcohol level, don't ordinarily perform their best. They're typically somebody other than who they might be if they hadn't consumed any alcohol. And I don't necessarily believe that the behavior was an exemplar of who Dr. Jane is. It may be an exemplar of who Dr. Jane is if he has too much alcohol to drink, but I think he's committed to the idea that that's never going to happen again.
It is definitely a warning sign, however. I mean, and I don't know if everything that you articulated very well came out in that psych report, but I certainly do support the idea of additional CME. I'm not sure about if this rises to probation. That was my reason for questioning further about the alcohol use, but that's my opinion. Thank you.
Thank you. So board members, we've got a couple things on the table. one of them would be 30 hours of CME, which is obviously required. In addition, ethics and professionalism, PBI, and then civility and communication, that's another PBI course. That could be in addition to his 30. And then the question would be, in a consent agreement draft, do you want any type of probation, 6 months, a year, any of that put into this consent agreement?
Could I jump in and ask a question of the board members on this, since it seems like there's a consensus on the CE, and the question is about probation. Would, aside from the CE, does anyone have any additional terms of probation that they'd want to see in there? And the reason I'm asking is because the board could just order the CE in a non-disciplinary order. And then if the concern is about Dr. J not completing the CE, that would be a violation of a board order, and then there could be a separate case. But of course, if the board wants additional terms of probation besides the CE, then probation would be the way to go.
Okay.
This is Dr. Popiel. Does doing a letter or a consent agreement with them probation, does that, I guess, is the board have any sort of liability should something happen and we didn't do a consent agreement for probation? Or is it just no big deal either way, you know, as far as how we decide to rule?
Well, I guess it depends on a few things, but if the, I guess what I'm saying is the non-disciplinary order for CE would accomplish, if the only concern is whether he completes the CE that the board orders, accomplishes the same thing as probation unless there are other terms, because the rest of the sort of boilerplate terms of probation are going to be don't commit any additional crimes, renew your license, stuff that, you know, he would already be doing. And then if he didn't complete the CE, there would be a method to address that later on.
Okay.
Hey, Casey, if, for instance, if the board was to do a 6 month probation and add the CME, right, and then we were to put a clause in there that if the CME is completed within 90 days and there has been no other, complaints made to the board, no other issues, right? That everything is done. In other words, if everything's completed and done and within 90 days, then we'll let them off early and we'll cut them loose with regard to the probation at that 90 day period. If he's done everything he's supposed to, is that something we can do, one, and two, does that seem like that might be a halfway point for everybody?
That is certainly something that the board can do in the probation. And I guess maybe one other thing to think about in this discussion is just an order for CE, that would be non-disciplinary. Probation is discipline.
Okay. So now it basically is whether or not the board feels that the totality of the circumstances warrant this physician walking away with a non-disciplinary or a disciplinary record.
Right. Yeah, I think maybe that's the biggest distinction.
I see. Other than a small issue at the very beginning with an attempt to speak with a board member, which I believe was handled by his attorney right away, and our board director addressed it immediately. I don't believe we have any conduct or behavioral issues that have occurred during this. And so personally, I suppose that if the other board members are comfortable with it, we could, you know, put it in a non-disciplinary format. And if he does the CME and everything works out, great. But if there is that concern that they wanted to have, you know, that extra official mandate upon which we move forward, then my suggestion about the 6-month probation and let him go after 90 days applies, and you know, and then we would have to obviously understand that you know, everything that occurred creates that unprofessional conduct, which would have to substantiate the justification for a disciplinary check on his record. But I'm actually okay with either one, depending on how the other board members feel.
I mean, my only concern is that it's twofold. One, I read obviously the psychological report, and then I went back through the police report in the DUI. So if we did, in order for non-disciplinary continuing CME with education, that sort of expunges all the things that happened in my mind in the past, i.e. the DUI, some of the issues that brought up in the psychological report. That's basically what's on my mind. I don't know how the other board members feel, but let's discuss it and see if we can come to closure.
This is Dr. Mobile. Dr. Static, you're saying do the CME and just leave it at that? I apologize. Yep. Or were you saying like a letter of concern even?
Yeah, I was thinking more, as was discussed, unless I'm unclear, is there's two avenues. One would be to do a consent agreement with a probationary period. And then the other would be, and Casey, correct me if I'm wrong, would be an issue for non-disciplinary continuing medical education with CME. The only thing that gets me on that one is the word non-disciplinary. So that's where I'm getting kind of hung up on. Whether we do a consent agreement with basically a disciplinary portion of the consent agreement and the CME, or whether we just let it go with a order for non-disciplinary. If that makes sense.
Yeah. I guess, you know, given that this is the steps have been taken to remedy, you know, doing what he can to, you know, follow through on what's been ordered. And, you know, this is so far a one-time deal and he's been in practice for a while. I would be okay as well with just a non-disciplinary letter for CME as well. I do feel like a letter of concern for unprofessional conduct is worthwhile as well.
Okay. Good. Other board members, let's get some feedback.
This is Dan, and I agree with that. I think a non-disciplinary letter, that's something that can be kept on file so that if something does happen in the future, it can be referenced.
Great. Thanks, Dan.
This is the first part. Yeah, I think letter of concern would also be indicated here, just in case something, hopefully in the future, we don't have any of this incident happen again, but letter of concern, I think, would help us so that we can track and see that we re-give the doctor the warning already.
Yeah. Dr. Brown, your thoughts?
I'm still kind of on the fence with that because we should be, well, our mandate is protect the public and protect the patients. And it just feels like he had a DUI and went to jail, misdemeanor, and to not have any disciplinary. Maybe we could do something like as he's going through his CME to have random alcohol testing to make sure that while he's going through that, he's not consuming alcohol or something a little bit more with the sting to it, because if something was to happen again, the board wouldn't look, it would make the board look, would put the board in a very vulnerable position. So that's my thought.
Thank you. Dr. Campbell, your thoughts?
I totally get where Dr. Brown is coming from 110%. I think one distinction that I've often seen and I serve one other board, in addition to this board, is whether or not when we're as a board addressing conduct on behalf of a licensee, is that conduct directly related to the profession? So in other words, we will hear cases that involve, as a medical board, involve patients and somebody's conduct, that arises out of them and in their performance of their official duties as doctors. And then we'll also hear conduct related to behavior, such as in this case, that involves the professional conduct of the professional outside of work. So the latter, what we're dealing with here today, while both are equally important, I think that the board has slightly more latitude with regard to conduct that doesn't directly relate to patients. Now, yes, there was an issue with the public, because of the DUI. I believe as a board, as we start to look at past incidences and how the board has handled, DUIs with other physicians in the past and how we might move forward in setting that precedent, it's going to be important to, come to some viable, happy medium that is fair for everybody, not too heavy-handed on one side or the other as an initial violation, and then taking that next step should, violations occur, somebody's not being in compliance, et cetera. So I totally get where Dr. Brown is coming from. And again, I'm happy either way. I mean, we can throw out a motion and see where it lands and go from there.
Let me get Ms. Gallen real quick to give us her opinion on it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I already kind of expressed my opinion. I'm kind of mulling it over right now. I don't know that I have anything more to add to that.
Okay.
Thanks.
So let me just ask Casey for his legal advice on this. One option, and I don't know if this is possible, but would be to issue a letter of concern along with a issue for an order for non-disciplinary continuing medical education. Could both of those be issued separately?
Yes, or they could be combined. They're both non-disciplinary options for the board. You maybe Gail's a better person to ask how it's been done before. They could be separate, or they could be the letter. You could just attach the letter to the order. It's either way.
Dr. Salzig, members of the board, this is Gail, and I typically do those separate.
Okay. So that's one option. Board members who are not looking on a probationary term would be to do two separate letters. One, issue a letter of concern. The other one would be issue an order for non-disciplinary CME. That would be in addition to his 30, was my thought, and those would be two PBI courses. We could come up with that. You'd have to complete that within either 90-day or a six-month period, and that would be up for the board to decide. So there's one motion, one thought. The other one would obviously be to utilize a letter of consent along with the item of having him in probation under that consent agreement. Any thoughts on those motions or thoughts?
Well, if you want, I can go ahead and second that first motion that you had, the first part of that.
Okay.
And we'll see where it goes.
All right.
This is Dan, so, and I'm supportive of that as well.
Okay, Ms. Bell is good with it.
Should we do a roll call?
Yes.
Dr. Papillo, are you?
On the first one.
Yeah, I'm leaning towards the first one as well right now.
Okay. Well, let's do a roll call, and then we can debate from there if we need to.
Could we clear up the motion and second real quick, just as a formality, before we go into roll call?
Sure. So what I was thinking, and our exec director said that she does these separately, would be issue a letter of concern. In addition, issue a order for non-disciplinary continuing medical education with two courses. One is civility and communication. The other one is ethics and professionalism. And this would be in addition to his 30 hours of CME within a 6-month time frame to have completed the additional CME.
And Dr. Sadlick, you made the original motion, and who seconded that, please?
Dr. King, Dr. Campbell, seconded that, I think.
Thank you. And would you like me to conduct a roll call?
Yes, please.
Okay. Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
Dr. Popiel?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
No.
Nay? Okay. And would you like to discuss your motion or just no?
Just no. I'm pretty, it was the same justification that I used before, so I'm going to stick to that.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. And Mr. Muller?
Aye.
Okay. And motion carries.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for your thoughts on 5A. And let's go ahead and move on to 5B as in boy. This is Dr. Jennifer Gentry, case number 24-272. This is the initial interview. And is Dr. Gentry on the phone?
Yes, Dr. Gentry should be on the phone, and good afternoon, Chairman Dr. Sadlick and members of the board. This is Leah Shacker on behalf of Dr. Gentry.
Hi, Ms. Shacker. Let's go ahead, and Ms. Anthony, can you give us a rundown on that?
Yes, and Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, this is case number 24272, Dr. Jennifer Gentry. The board received a complaint from DL, who alleges respondent failed to do routine blood work to check vitamin D levels, resulting in 16 food sensitivities and vitamin D deficiency, and that she failed to properly diagnose and treat a bee sting. DL first presented to respondent on 11-8 of 2013. She was diagnosed with Lyme disease the prior April through testing done by a different provider. She reported a tick bite in June of 2003 and had refused antibiotic treatment. According to her intake form, DL reported food allergies at that time, gluten, peanut, dairy, eggs, and reporting all were related to her Lyme disease. In addition, she reported an allergy to a blood pressure medication, but she didn't know the name of the medication at that time. Available labs results in the patient chart reflect thyroid levels were periodically checked by respondent. However, the years of treatment, it appears routine labs generally were not run. A CBC was ordered by respondent in June 2024. However, vitamin D level was not included. As part of her complaint, DL submitted lab results from a provider she began seeing after her final contact with respondent. The lab reported a low vitamin D level, slightly of 28.8 with a reference range of 30.0 to 108. DL alleges respondent failed to properly treat a bee sting she received in June of 2023. However, she did continue to see response through 20 of 24.
Thank you. Dr. Gentry, I just have a couple quick questions. In reference to bee stings, cellulitis, those types of issues, as you know, you have a realm of antibiotics to use. What would the normal dosing of Keflex or Cephalexin be?
For cellulitis, it would be 4 times a day. She didn't present that day, however, with a picture of cellulitis, rather an inflammatory response to a bee sting. And I prescribed a steroid for that. I did give it an antibiotic as a prophylactic approach at twice a day because I didn't think it was cellulitis.
Do you think you would have been better off treating it with the full dose of Keflex along with the Medrol dose pack?
It's possible, but she was there she went to the ER the next day. She wouldn't have even had time to take 4 doses. So I sent her to the ER rather than increasing the dose because I was concerned that if it was cellulitis and what I had prescribed hadn't worked, then she might have needed something more along the lines of vancomycin. I just sent her in an abundance of caution rather than telling her over the phone to increase her dose.
Okay, so then you were the one that made the referral to ED.
Yes, I did.
Okay.
And if I can just add to that, I think one important point there is just that at the time that the patient presented to Dr. Gentry, she was assessing and certainly had infection or the potential for cellulitis on her differential, but that was not how the patient presented at that time. And it wasn't until 24 hours later when she went to the emergency department that the ED physician, based on the note we have, said that there appears to be a component of cellulitis and increased the dose, which Dr. Gentry, as she stated, would have done at the outset if she felt there was cellulitis, but she certainly counseled the patient on following up what symptoms to look for, and the patient called back into the office, and Dr. Gentry immediately decided to refer her to the emergency department, which she did and was treated and the issue resolved.
Great. I understand. Dr. Gentry, what do you think, or kind of hypothesis of why the patient made the complaint in the first place? There's multiple factors I see. I'm just trying to turf through them.
I think she's under a lot of stress. She has a lot of pain, a lot of stress in her life. And she wanted answers, and I wasn't able to give her the answers she wanted. And so she went to another physician. And I think she liked what they had to say more.
Okay. And if I may add to that, I think that just kind of taking into account this patient's clinical picture, she was complaining of a host of issues. At no point, she did note some food sensitivities at the outset of treatment. She had some insight into that it was related to her Lyme disease. She really was seeking treatment with Dr. Gentry for an alternative to her Lyme disease because she did not want to pursue first line of treatment with antibiotic therapy. And she wanted to treat her constant fatigue, her stress, her tension. And then from there, as you can see over the 10 years, there are multiple other issues that she asked for treatment for. But at no point was it raising this issue of food sensitivities again. Obviously, Lyme disease, you know, as a chronic illness, it's difficult, and I think this patient and all patients seem to struggle with it, and especially because she was not amenable to the antibiotic therapy. Vitamin D testing was not indicated for this patient. At the outset of treatment, her vitamin D levels were within normal range, but Dr. Gentry did put her on a vitamin D regimen, and which she self-discontinued. She had a tendency to do that during treatment, discontinue her blood pressure medications, discontinue vitamin D therapy. And then even in these recent labs that we see the level of 28.8 per UpToDate and SonoraQuest reference ranges, that is within normal range. So her complaint that her vitamin D is per the Vibrant America lab that she used, it does tend to have a large range by comparison to those that are more widely accepted. But at most, her vitamin D is low normal range. And certainly there's nothing in the literature to support that that's the cause of her food sensitivities, which is what I believe she was told by the subsequent provider.
Thank you. I agree with you, but let me go ahead and get my other board members to give me some feedback. Dr. Popiel?
Sure. I agree with that statement as well, that it's unlikely that the food sensitivities were caused by the lack of vitamin D. I don't agree with the idea that that's not potentially therapeutically relevant. Dr. Gentry, with the, you know, the initial intake and treatment of this patient, it looks like you did a fair amount of labs. My concern is essentially 10 years of treating this patient with hormone replacement therapy, with suggesting vitamin D. How are you evaluating the actual efficacy of your treatments if you're not doing actual lab work to check, to follow these lab values?
I treated her chronic fatigue mostly with thyroid replacement and hormone replacement, in addition to recommending, you know, just good nutrition. And I did regular follow up on her thyroid. On her hormones, I did follow up, but I also just monitored her symptoms. When I tried to increase an estrogen, for example, she had bleeding. There would be no reason to test for blood work because that's a sign in itself that it's too much. Then I did follow up testing her testosterone levels over the years, and they were normal consistently. So unless there's symptoms of a need to test, there's no reason. And then in her initial assessment, I did a thorough, and it was fairly normal. The patient insisted that I do only what is absolutely necessary to monitor her health over the years, and I feel like that I did that.
Okay. I would definitely personally disagree with you on the idea that you should not be monitoring this patient's hormone levels. You know, let's say the patient did have vaginal bleeding. Yeah, sure, that might be an indication of excess estrogen, but you wouldn't know that, and you wouldn't know how to make any dosing changes based on that. So, you know, I definitely have a concern with the lack of complete labs run for this patient. I mean, I would assume you, in my opinion, vitamin D is going to be an extremely important value for somebody with chronic infection. And I would want to know whether the levels are actually in the optimal range. I definitely feel, I just disagree with you on the hormone replacement. I don't feel like that's a safe way to practice, having a patient on hormones and not seeing the follow-up labs to determine whether you are actually getting, number one, anything that's excessive. Number two, I personally have goals on, let's say I have a patient on estradiol replacement therapy. I'm shooting for a level of 50 to 100. I understand the idea that you have to take symptoms into account with these patients, but I also feel like from a just liability standpoint, you're doing yourself a disservice not actually having lab values, despite whatever the patient tells you. I don't want this. I don't want that. It's on you from a liability standpoint. So regardless of whether if that patient is disagreeing with you and not willing to do labs, in my opinion, that's somebody who you don't need to treat, because that's a liability on your part. So I do have some concerns with the lack of follow-up labs being run, particularly with the length of time this patient was on treatment. I don't really have much for concern as to the treatment for the bee stings at this point. That's all I have for now.
If we may just respond to that, I think the point is well taken, certainly, and Dr. Gentry has throughout the course of this case certainly recognized she kind of put herself in a bit of a precarious situation with treating a patient who there was some treatment pro bono because of the patient's husband, who is also a practitioner, and she was very concerned about finances, this patient. And so Dr. Gentry, you know, not to say she still felt that she was doing what was reasonably reasonable, but in hindsight does see that, you know, she could have increased labs and that type of follow-up and kind of not let those concerns from the patient dictate her considerations for treatment.
Thank you. Dr. Spatt, let me roll to you.
Hi, Dr. Gentry. Dr. Spatt. I just go along with what was, I'm just going to follow up and piggyback on what Dr. Poppy was asking. So did you go mainly with how the patient present itself, or mainly what patient's saying to you on your assessment skill? I'm just want to know.
Are you referring to the hormone replacement, sir?
Yes.
So I always listen to the patient for both. I began her on hormone replacement in 2014, and after that, I did lab follow-up, and her lab values were normal, and she was seeing improvement. And so I left her on that dose. Again, in 2021, we reassessed. I ran blood work again. Again, it was normal. She was okay with her hormone at that time. I think she was under a lot less stress as well, and so was seeing a little bit of improvement. Left her at the same dose. And then she went through a really rough time, and her symptoms became more apparent with her chronic Lyme. Reevaluated in July of 2024. Again, her estrogen levels were in a safe range. If I go any higher, she bleeds, so I can't go any higher.
Okay. And, Dr. Gentry, how often do you usually do a blood test on a hormone patient?
Once the patient is established and doing well, I don't feel that it's absolutely necessary. You test in order to make a change, and if they're doing well and they're in menopause, nothing's going to change. So.
Okay. But how often, like, let's say if, a new patient come in on your assessment, initial assessment, and after you do the initial, so a blood test on hormonal replacement, how often? Well, what's your, do you have a protocol? Do you have a routine?
Yes, sir. I usually test at 3 months. I recommend a 3-month checkup. And then if it's normal, if I would ideally like to check again at 1 year, and then only if a symptom indicates after that, if it's normal. I always do a follow up after I begin, and I recommend it 1 more year. But after that, there's really no need with hormones because nothing should change. Now, okay. With thyroid, I check every year because...
Okay, all right. Thank you. I just want to see what your thought is. Okay, thank you. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dr. Spatt. Dr. Campbell?
Yes. I would like to ask the physician... when you say that, you know, the patient was doing well so that you didn't feel labs were necessary, were you at all concerned about things like clotting risks or liver function issues or any type of silent cardiovascular changes, which don't always present with obvious symptoms?
I was not thinking of that. She was on such a low dose. When I began her treatment therapy, we were of the belief at that time to use the least amount of hormone possible due to fears of breast cancer. And she was also using it in a topical form. And topical estrogen has a very low risk of blood clots.
And how do you think that the interplay of Lyme disease impacts all of that?
Her chronic Lyme, it improved. She had some improvement in her pain with hormone replacement. I would have liked to have tried a higher dose, but even back then, I was leery to go higher because of our fears of breast cancer at the time. Things have changed now, and we know that we can go much higher without that risk, but But at the time, we didn't know that.
I would also note that at the time when her, when she came with the exacerbated symptoms, Dr. Gentry also did provide the patient with a number of referrals to specialty, including cardiology and neurology at that time.
Okay. Let me see what else I have here on my list. Give me one second. Yeah, I definitely would, I want to emphasize how important regular lab monitoring is, you know, as a preventative approach. We want to avoid those silent progressive complications. And, I think it's definitely important that we advocate that this physician do so in the future. 100%. That's all I have at this moment. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Campbell. Dr. Brown, can I move on to you?
Yes, I agree with Dr. Campbell. I think regular lab testing is very important, typically for thyroid and sex hormone conditions. I would go with every 120 days. That's my motto. As far as the bee sting management, I thought that was responsible as far as referring the patient to the ER. That's all I have at this time, but I do think that regularly testing and follow-up testing should be part of the protocol.
Ms. Gallon?
Yep, I'm just kind of mulling it over and listening right now. I don't know if I have anything to add.
And Mr. Miller?
Yeah, I just do have one question. I do appreciate your response on the complete labs, but I do have a question. If there was any personal animosity just in reviewing this at the first, it just seemed that there was something more beneath the surface of this entire complaint. And can you address that at all? Was there something else going on here?
I don't think so. I was actually really shocked when I received the complaint because she'd been with me for so very long. In her letter, she notes that she found it difficult to get in. I think she had to wait a month. I think that upset her, most likely. But I have to say, even that was unusual to me because patients have complete access to me. They have my cell phone. They have my email. I make myself completely available to my patients at all the time. And so patients, if they can't get in and it's still serious, they'll often call me personally, and I'll get them in. And she made no effort to do that. I don't really know.
Okay. One thing that may be worth noting with this patient and her complaint is that, you know, over the years, she requested many FMLA forms at various times over the years, but not in 2024. She had reported that she quit work due to stress. But then Dr. Gentry was aware that she had started a new yoga studio, in June, I believe June of 2023. And she had reported that she felt this would be less stressful. So she had decided to open her own business, and was doing that instead. So I'm not sure what changed there. I don't imagine that's necessarily less stressful, but that's how she perceived the situation.
Okay, thank you for that.
Board members, any other questions?
This is Dr. Popiel. I just wonder if the complainant is on the line.
I didn't see her pop up, Dr. Popiel, so I don't think she's...
Okay, just making sure.
Yeah, thank you. So we have a couple of issues. One, which was fairly well illustrated by Dr. Campbell and Dr. Popiel, was the bioidentical hormone replacement therapeutics. And then the other issue was, which I think she explained well enough, was the antimicrobial prescribing, which she knows obviously the dosing of that. and the patient was referred to EM that took care of that. So where we're, and correct me if I'm wrong, board members, where we're kind of at an impasse is the laboratory serologies for hormonal replacement therapeutics. Perhaps the diagnosis of fatigue, whether that be autoimmune etiologies, other things buried in there, but that didn't come up in this case. And then my concern for her not to have a future would be maybe just learn boundaries of some sort so she doesn't find herself in this predicament again. So we could look at CME for, and that would be up to the board as to HRT replacement. And then possibly, of course, to help prevent her from having this happen again would be maybe an educational course on boundaries.
This is Dr. Popiel, I like that idea. I would be thinking kind of like just a letter of concern for failure to do adequate lab testing and then some additional CME. I think that would be very reasonable. I don't think this rises to the letter of a consent agreement.
Yeah, I agree. What do you think, Dr. Popiel, for the CME? Do you feel as though the hormonal replacement's under control?
I would. I mean, that's obviously an area I'd kind of work in mainly, and you know, every seminar I've ever been to, you know, talks a lot more about the lab evaluation. So I just feel like that's, you know, as a naturopathic physician, getting a full set of labs, B vitamins, thyroid, adrenals, testosterone, vitamin D, iron. I mean, I just feel like that's all a necessity at least once a year. Particularly, there was a number of years it seemed like this patient was only in once a year. So I just feel like at a minimum, maybe some refresher courses on hormone replacement and kind of current standards of practice is not a bad idea.
Any course that you like that anyone puts on?
No, I mean, unfortunately, most of them are just like 30 hours, et cetera. I don't know of any specifically. We can kind of maybe look at that. I don't know of any off the top of my head that would be more like an 8 to 10 hour refresher course. So,
okay. Dr. Campbell.
I concur with everything you guys have said. I like, I know that there was a reading something about a bioidentical HRT optimization in clinical conversation course by the MPI. I don't remember how long it was. That might be something we can look into. And then also I think the ethical considerations with regard to, you know, physicians and responsibilities. You know, the AMA offers a lot of good stuff. Specifically, I think ethic and legal responsibilities and patient monitoring would be good. Thank you.
And Dr. Spatt?
Well, so far, everything that Dr. Popiel and Dr. Campbell say, I agree with it. I don't have any other input at the moment.
Okay. I'll move to Dr. Brown.
I'm in agreement with what everyone is saying.
Okay. And then Ms. Gallen?
I agree also. I don't really have anything more to add.
Mr. Miller?
I think the HRT and ethics would be good. I'm not sure about the boundaries. With all due respect, I'm not sure if that's necessary, but the other two I would support.
Okay. All right, does someone want to make a motion? Maybe an issue for your Order for Non-Disciplinary Continuing Medical CME.
Yeah, this is Dr. Bobby. I'll work through a motion. I make a motion for a letter of concern for failure to do adequate medical lab follow-up with an additional order for CME. I would think 10 hours, half of which to include hormone replacement, half of which to include, what else did we say on that?
Oh, the other half was I'm trying to prevent her having, you know, this unfortunate issue sometimes with patient conflict. So I was looking at trying to help her with some type of course that might help her establish better boundaries of some sort with patients.
Well, maybe we can, I don't know if we can ask the executive director to maybe find something or approve on that. But maybe we can just kind of leave it slightly open as far as exactly what course we're looking for once we find it. Maybe kind of follow it up at that point.
Sure.
And Dr. Salik, members of the board, this is Gail. And so you're looking at a order for CME 10 hours. Is that in addition to the 30?
Dr. Papil, what's your thought?
I would say yes.
Okay. And how long does she have to complete those?
6 months, I would say.
That's what I was thinking, 6 months, yeah.
Okay. And I have an idea of the CME you're looking for. Did you want me to bring that back for your approval or just draft it as is?
I would say draft it as is.
Okay.
Do you want a second motion on that?
So, Dr. Papil, you made the original motion. Was there a second on that?
I was at Mr. Puspat. I seconded.
Okay. And Dr. Sadlick, would you like me to do roll call?
Yes, please.
Okay. And Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
Dr. Papil?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Spat?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
And Mr. Miller?
Aye.
And motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gentry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, board members, let's move on. We're into number 5, and we'll do 5. C as in cat. And that's Michelle, is it Eason and Matthew Eason, unlicensed, case number 24-273. And this is the initial review. Ms. Anthony will give us a review.
Okay. Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, this complaint came by way of a licensed naturopathic physician in the state of Arizona. And after review of the information provided, it appears respondents are using protected titles in connection with an Arizona location. Respondents suggest that they are merely acting as educators. However, it is clear that they are charging a fee for services, selling service memberships, and selling devices such as the H-Wave therapy machine, which they claim to be a drug-free way to eliminate pain and restore your body's natural vitality. This particular device is being offered by respondents for rent at $250 a month or purchase at $3,960. In the event the board finds that the medical services or items being promoted are a threat to the public health and safety, the matter should be forwarded to other agencies for further investigation into the practice.
Let me, Matthew, it looks like you're on the line.
Yes, sir.
Can you, just so that I'm clear, I read the data and the literature that you presented us. What was your goal? Your unlicensed. Do you hold any type of medical license of any sort?
No, sir.
What were you trying to actually do then? Can you clarify that for me?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're always been teachers. You know, we have a place in Texas, and we just recently have this place in Arizona. And so, I mean, we just try to educate only. I mean, our website, we try to just educate. We always define what a doctor is, which is just to teach. Anytime anyone either asks us or anytime we're connecting with people, we definitely clearly state that we're not licensed physicians in any way, but that we're just here to educate. We're both pretty much big on education, and educators always have been.
I mean, here's my concerns. Basically, there were some references to naturopathy. There were some references to, quote, you know, term doctor. The problem is, if somebody is not being properly diagnosed and they have a condition that needs to be diagnosed and treated, you have just slowed up their prognosis and their proper diagnosis, et cetera. And that's where I have, you know, my concerns. And the device you were selling, what if the patient had Medtronic, any type of other device implanted in them, and then you're giving them a electronic device? There's so many complications that can happen with this, and that's my concern.
I 100% agree. And so this was information given by the H-Wave company that we just kind of put up. We don't handle anybody that comes across that page. The H-Wave company does. So we definitely don't come at it from that angle. And, I can only say that I would never recommend any, you know, or make any suggestion like that. I would definitely have them connect with any licensed physician. And then especially if there was any sort of electrical device connected to them.
I need to get my other board members involved with this. Let me ask Dr. Popiel what his thoughts are.
You guys are not quote unquote unlicensed naturopathic doctors from like Clayton College or anything. You don't necessarily, like you said, you don't have any necessarily clinical training.
I mean, I definitely come from a background of a lot of training. I have a family of doctors, but I have no formal education like that. I have received a doctor of naturopathy from First National University under Dr. Von William Peters, if that answers your question.
Okay. Yeah, I just was curious if you had any training. I just didn't know how you even got to the idea of portraying naturopathic principles if you hadn't been to some sort of naturopathic training, whether it's licensed or not.
A First National University, yes, sir.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, I echo Dr. Stadler's concerns. Have you guys essentially, I think, you know, Executive Director Anthony was commenting on most anything that was concerning on the website had been changed. Is that where things stand? Anything that would be leading to the assumption that you're a physician has been removed from the website?
100%. Not only that, we removed it from the website. Then we also went to our YouTube channel and scrubbed any doctor out of any video. Also consulted with a compliance person to make extra considerations that go beyond just using the protected word in Arizona state of doctor. 100%.
Okay. I don't have any additional questions, Dr. Sadler.
Dr. Spath?
I don't have any questions at the moment. Thank you.
Dr. Campbell?
Nothing right now. Thank you.
Dr. Brown?
No, I don't have anything. Thank you.
Ms. Gallen?
I don't have anything either.
And Mr. Muller?
I would just say I would want you to remove the reference to doctor, not just to the state of Arizona, but to anywhere.
100%. That's already, yes. anywhere that we have access to that, yeah, 100%. We've already taken
steps. Okay, you said the state of Arizona.
Yeah, because we also live in, you know, Texas, right? So we spend some time here in Arizona at this point over the last year, and then we spend time in Texas because we have there. But yes, yes, 100%.
Mr. Pascal, is there a way we can monitor their website?
Yes, I can monitor that to see what changes have been made, and if the board wants me to, I can log back onto the internet, you know, at large and monitor those changes as well.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Matthew, what have you done with the people that you quote unquote treated or helped? Have you informed them, that you will no longer be doing that?
We've never treated Ender, ever. We don't treat, we don't diagnose. We've never done that. Even when we were in Texas more permanently than we are today, we still never did that.
And what was Texas's thought with what you were doing?
They don't have naturopathic regulations. So using the word doctor with the educational background doesn't hold the same meaning in Texas, as I understand it, as it does here in Arizona, as I currently understand it, at least.
Okay. So, board members, I see possibly doing this, allowing our executive director to go on in 30 days and check through all social media, et cetera, that he has scrubbed anything that has to do with diagnosis, medicine, naturopathic, doctor, et cetera. And if not, then we have one or two choices. He can come back and explain it to it, or we could just simply refer it to the Attorney General's office.
If that's a motion, I'd second it. So
can I ask one follow-up question?
Sure.
Just based off of scrubbing, so I guess my only question is, there's like something called like scrib.com or something, and they just scour for information, and anybody can upload anything. And I remember one of the pieces had doctor on it, an old material from a year or more ago, when we were obviously in Texas. And so would I be responsible for also third party trying to figure out to contact that company and being responsible for trying to get them to take it down?
I think that would be the best bet, and to provide documentation that you have tried to contact those companies.
Okay.
To have the email address in the time that you tried to attempt to contact them. That way would back up what you're saying better.
Awesome. Okay.
This is Dr. Popiel. So Dr. Sadlick, are you saying just postpone this case for a month to allow for executive director to monitor the website?
Monitor the website. And he also said he, unless I'm not understanding you correctly, you mentioned you would get a hold of all the extraneous companies.
Yeah.
So show us the email, show us the times, et cetera, that you have made attempts to remove doctor, naturopathic, et cetera.
That sounds like a good plan from me.
So that would be my motion. I think Dr. Papil second. Any other thoughts on that?
Can I just ask one question?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
With regard to your device, the therapy machine, when you marketed the actual machine, what are you marketing it about? Like, what are you telling people it's for? What does it treat or diagnose, if anything, et cetera?
I don't. I mean, we just met them at a fair. We liked what their product was. We got one ourselves. And then, they asked if they could put you know, information on our website. You know, since they kind of manage everything, we said that's fine. But it definitely doesn't diagnose anything. And as far as I know, it, other than helping with pain, that's as far as I guess have information on that.
Are you aware if this machine has any classification with the FDA as far as being a medical an approved medical device?
It is approved medical device, and it's approved through also the VA. Yeah, yes, sir. As far as I know and as I understand it, it is a Class 2 medical device.
Okay. All right, thank you. Mr. Chairman, that was it. I appreciate that.
Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, Dr. Campbell, as a follow-up to that, I just want to be clear, as far as I know during the course of investigating this matter, it looks like there's two devices being used. There's one called the H-Wave therapy machine, which quite frankly looks a lot like a TENS unit. And then there's another one that they're doing voice analysts or analysis or something to that effect. So which machine were you referring to, Dr. Campbell, or both?
Thank you for that. In my specific question, I believe, my mind was towards the therapy machine. Are you talking about I guess I can ask this, Mr. Ensign, is it a voice stress analyzer?
It does a energetic voice frequency. As far as I know, I'm not sure if I would call it it does stressor, but it's doing energetic frequency. And so it takes the voice and turns it into energetic frequencies.
Okay. And, Gail, please finish.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I just wanted to make sure, it was clear that there's two machines in use here or being sold or whatever you want to call it, in terms of this matter. So I wanted to be clear on which one or both of you are referring to.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. Yes. I appreciate that.
Any other questions? I think we've got a motion. I think we got a second. You can take a total roll. Does anyone have any other questions?
I was just going to say real quick, if the board's just going to table this, you don't even need, a motion or a vote since you're not taking any action.
Okay. So
I'm clear. You are giving respondents 30 days to scrub the internet. I am to review that and bring this back to the board at next meeting.
Yes, please.
Okay.
Any other questions board members have in that case? No. Okay, let's move on then. We're out of number five. Let's move on to number six. This would be review consideration and possible action regarding the status of judicial review action filed by Colleen Huber. For the new board members, would you like us to go into executive session for this? It's up to the new board members, the old board members also obviously know this case well. Anyone want to go into executive?
I don't think so.
Okay.
No. Such an extensive, I don't know. I would say no.
Okay.
Up to you guys, though.
Mr. Hutchinson, what's your thoughts?
I don't really have, there's a small update. I think at the last meeting, I might have mentioned that there was an amicus brief filed in this case on the 15th of January. The state filed its response to that brief on February 4th. So I think now finally all of the briefing is finished. So we're just now in a holding pattern waiting to get an oral argument date from the Court of Appeals.
Okay. Any questions, board members, on number 6? All right, let's move on to number 7, review, consideration, possible action regarding executive director request for salary adjustment. That was in the board packet, and I'll make the motion that we approve that. Need a second.
This is Dr. Copiel. I'll second that.
And could you make a roll on that, Gail?
Yes. Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
Dr. Copiel?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Dr. Brown?
Aye.
Mr. Mellor?
Aye.
And motion carries, and I thank you all very much.
Thank you. Okay, let's go on to number 8, review, consideration, possible action regarding Article 2 of the rule draft.
So, board members, there's a lot of information here. This is the rule draft. What I'm looking for are the board members to review. If you want changes, if you want things struck, I just need an overview of this, an approval of this, and then I will send it on its way through the procedure. I tried to make it, I know there's a lot of information, and it's my apologies, because I know it's a lot. And it doesn't have to be approved today. I just want to kind of get your first sort of blush on it, what you think. You looking for changes? Were you able to read it? Read it.
So we had a couple of things, board members. We had all of the, obviously, 8 House bills. Then we had the Arizona Auditor General report.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dr. Salek. This we're doing the rules.
Right.
With you? Yeah.
Right, yeah. And then we have Title IV, Professions, Occupations. So I'm just trying to make sure everyone's on the same stack of paper or the same computer screen.
And so all the details that are in red will be the proposed changes or additions or deletions, depending on the particular sentence. Is that about right, Gail?
Yes, that's correct, Dr. Campbell. I tried to put everything in red and underlined, which would be the new language. The old language would be strike throughs. And then I have a couple questions that I put in red and highlighted in yellow. I don't know if the board wants to address those. I think the biggest change here, because the board's gone through this once before a while back, I think the biggest change right now is going to be the CMEs. The board wanted to do 20 versus 30, so we're striking through 30, putting in 20. But in doing that, I changed the at least 8 required it to 7 required. And we put in their language about the opioid. If the person has a DEA certificate, then they would need to participate in that 3 hours of opioid. So I tried to even it out a little bit with just that change. And I don't know if it makes sense to everybody or not.
I was able to understand it. It sounded good to me. Just out of curiosity, with regard to the applicant must complete the required background check using the process outlined on the application, mm-hmm. Does that Does that mean like getting a level one fingerprint card or something like through what DPS offers through their fingerprint clearance system, or is that something different?
It's something different. So we do actually require a full background, so FBI DPS report. And so about a year ago, we changed to using the DPS website where they have to register and then they go to a place called Fieldprint. So it's all done electronically and it takes it off of the board's plate, because in the past, applicant would send in an actual fingerprint card with a money order and we would be responsible to get that to DPS and get the physical reports. So everything's done electronically now and it's been so much faster. Like, we get things within days, and before it was literally taking weeks to get. So, so I kind of put that in there. So I would put the procedure in the application process.
Nice. Yeah. No, if you get to, your route just as well, you know, going in a different way and it reduces that, extra legwork, then that's wonderful.
Yeah, it's been so awesome. The amount of time is cut into a quarter. It's just been great.
Glad to hear it.
Any other comments on?
This is Dan. I have a quick just point of information, I guess. I support the whole 20 hours of CME. Has there ever been a discussion in the past relating to virtual versus in-person CME?
We do allow the virtual CME, yes.
No, I know that, but has there ever been a discussion about of the 20 hours, have we ever discussed anything like that of having certain in-person requirements besides just doing virtual?
No, I don't believe that the board has discussed that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think at some point in the future it could be good for, and that maybe that's not our jurisdiction either, but I think sometimes that can be good in terms of learning, that reducing to 20, but having a portion that could be in person to make more of a community or sharing of information, I think can be advantageous for doctors. Just my opinion. But thank you for that.
Thank you. And on that note, too, I do have a question. I'm looking at it now. Right now, our statute says 1 hour of credit is allowed for every 50 minutes of participation in an approved continuing medical education activity, unless otherwise noted in R418-205B. Do we want to change that to read just 1 hour of credit is allowed for each clock hour of participation in approved continuing medical education activities?
It sure seems like that it's making a suggestion that it's very quick to get your 1 hour, 15 minutes and you've got one credit. I don't know. I guess I would have to defer to the people that are actually follow it, via their licensure that are on the board, the physicians, but just perceptually, it seems like it's a pretty quick thing.
Does any board members, you feel as though we need to change it, or do you feel as though we need to leave it as it is?
Do we have to change it by today?
No. I can bring this back next meeting.
Okay, because so that we can have some time looking at how the AMA is doing it as well.
Any feedback from the association?
In regarding to what?
No, I see we have I think Tracelyn's on the line. Mm-hmm. Any feedback?
On what specifically? My apologies.
Oh, in reference to the CMEs.
We had made one request, and Gail and I had corresponded about it, to include Nancy Act and the changes to the rules on CME. But that's it in terms of CME from our perspective.
Okay. So, board, would you like to have this brought back next meeting? And if so, then is there anything that we would like to concentrate on? One would be what, the CME in terms of 50 minutes equals 1 hour, that type of item? Or do you feel we're what the executive director's done is good?
I think where things are, are you saying 5-0 or 15?
5-0.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
15.
Then so I think it's fine.
Yeah. As it reads right now, it's 5-0, 15 minutes of participation is approved for 1 hour. That's how it reads now.
Okay.
My bad. I thought it was 1-5.
I heard that too. I was like, well, that seems, that's perception wise, that's not good.
I was looking like, what?
That was very generous of you, Dr. Campbell.
Yeah. I think 5-0 is fine. I wouldn't need to change that.
Okay. It's okay. In that case, I think we're okay because I was confused too.
So I can leave that.
Yeah.
I agree. But most of like Medscape and a lot of that is, 0.50, equals 1 hour. So.
Okay.
I think that's kind of the standard.
Okay.
Yes.
Anything else on that?
Tracy just raised her hand.
Okay.
Just a quick comment. What we typically do is we have speakers speak for 50 minutes and then do 10 minutes of Q&A. So that's our standard format in terms of CME.
Okay.
Cool. So we can leave that. I guess the other point I wanted to ask specifically is because we added NANSIAC, but then we have a portion in here that says one credit hour may be claimed for each 8-hour day of training in an internship training program, a preceptorship training program, or a postdoctoral training program approved by the board, maximum of 8 hours. Usually those participating in an intern or precept program are not licensed physicians, so there's no need for us to approve CME for those. I'm wondering if the board is all right with me striking that.
It might be better to strike it because otherwise I think it could be confusing.
Okay.
But that's just my opinion. Other board members, it'd be great to get your feedback on it.
And this is Dr. Wolpe. Isn't it the preceptor who's doing the training that gets the continuing education? Or is it the person receiving the training? I thought the person who was like, let's say somebody came to my office and was preceptoring with me. I thought the physician who was allowing the preceptorship got CMEs, but I could be totally wrong.
That may be what this meant. I can change it to make it more clear if that's acceptable.
Like add instructor somewhere.
Yeah, because.
Because that would make it fair for those of us who do preceptorship who have students.
Okay, if the board doesn't mind, I can maybe reword that and make it a little bit more clear and bring it back for approval.
Perfect.
Okay,
that's good.
And then maybe when you do that, Gail, could you make it clear for the providers that offer that some type of format or form that they would submit for the preceptorship that they allowed at their office for the doctor to get the CME for it.
Yes, I will add that in there.
Okay.
Now, regarding preceptorship, is it just only mainly naturopathic student only, or can it be medical assistant, nursing student? What are we
I just want to see what the detail is.
It just says training program, preceptorship training program. We give out certificates for the licensees to conduct a preceptorship training program for naturopathic graduates. So I mean, and Casey, maybe you can add to this, but I would think the way the statute and rules are written, it's only for naturopathic preceptorships.
The reason why I ask is because at my office, I do have a medical assistant rotating through, and I also have nursing student rotating to the clinic as well. So I just want to know if that's qualified as well.
That's a very good question. If it's unclear in the rule, then it probably doesn't have a satisfactory answer. But this would be the time to bring it up. If we're talking about editing that for clarity anyway.
This is Dr. Popiel. I would think it should be only as a naturopathic student. That'd be my opinion.
Yeah, this is Dan, and I absolutely agree with that too. It should just be naturopathic students.
Now, with regard to Dr. Brown, my apologies.
I'm sorry. You go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just saying with regard to the medical assistance that the board, you know, actually does license, you know, I know that there's medical assistance for all the different forms of medical practice, but with regard to the ones that we do license, would we do it for physicians? And I don't know if we have a CME requirement for the medical assistance that we license or not. But if we did, then it would probably make sense to add those two, since, you know, it's our responsibility to license them. Then do we have a CME requirement for them, or is it?
No, we do not. They don't require CME.
Most of the CMA, certified medical assistants, get their CME or get their accreditation. There's an actual national body that they can get their continuing education from. So a lot of them now graduating have already completed the national test that would allow them to go to other states and be a CMA.
Now, let's say that, well, Mr. Chairman, let's say that you decide you're going to put on an 8-hour training for all Arizona licensed medical assistants, right? Would we want to be able to give you, as a result of doing that and, you know, and maybe bringing all those professionals together and doing a day training or something, would the instructors who are licensed by this board, would we want to allow them, you know, credit in the same way that we do for the preceptorship training for this? And if so, should we add that, or should we just leave things the way it is?
And I think that's a great question. If a provider, let's say, obviously we're dealing with licensed naturopathic physicians, did such a thing, in my mind, they should probably apply for some type of credit. They could either do it through they could possibly even do it through the AZNMA, that they're putting on a course. And I don't know, Trace Lynn, if the AZNMA would be interested in it, but whoever is doing it probably should get some type of credit. How much is a great question. I don't really know.
Might incentivize more involvement in that format as well.
You bet. I think it's a good idea.
Do you think you can think of a creative way to add that in, Gail?
I can try.
doesn't have to be anything, you know, too big of a deal.
I will try. I will make the discussed changes. And then with the board's permission, bring it back next month to maybe get more feedback and or approval.
Thanks. Awesome.
Any other questions on that agenda item? Okay, so it sounds like we'll be revisiting that next month. And let's move on to, if we're done with number eight, let's move on to number nine, executive director report. And we'll go through 9A, B, C, D, E, and F. So, Gail, the floor is yours.
That's terrifying. A is the budget. B is the current license numbers. C, we have the board cases under investigation and those numbers. And we move on to the rules update, and we just went through the rules on Article 2. So we'll bring that back next month, hopefully get an approval on that, and then move it forward. Legislative update is, I sent, I think, 3 emails with some of the bills that are being run this session. I just want the board to be aware of that. This is early on in the session, and we just will keep track of these bills through the end of the session. And they are subject to change on a daily basis, so it's really hard to say what's going to end up passing and possibly vetoed or what's going to end up not going anywhere. It's just so early in the process.
This is Dr. Popiel. I got a quick question for you, Gail, on the one that specifically relates to the to another physician and her case with the board and the idea of proprietary information. Mm-hmm. Does that ever come to, like, whoever sponsored that bill, does that ever then come to the board for our input, or is it just debated within the legislature?
No, she has not reached out for a stakeholders meeting on that. So I didn't even know what to say about that.
I mean, it certainly flies in the face of standard of care for a licensed physician and their chart notes. So, I mean, it seems like a poorly planned out bill, if you will, to like propose that we can treat with proprietary means without documenting it on our chart notes. So, I didn't know just how our comments, if anything, would be taken or if anybody even wants to hear what we have to say.
Yeah.
She
hasn't reached out for a stakeholders meeting. Whether that bill even gets heard, that I can't say. I do feel like there's a lot of legal problems with the way it's drafted. Of course, you know, Casey can speak to that better than I, but I feel like it goes against specific statutes that are already in play, and not just for our board, for healthcare boards in general. So,
and just out of curiosity for myself, is that drafted or is that legislation proposed by the same representative or whatever that was in question to how the naturopathic board was handling?
Yes.
Our cases?
That yes.
Was the same okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, we've had, this is Dr. Campbell. We've had some recent changes, on the other board that I serve on, the Board of Technical Registration. And there was no involvement, requested by the board prior to the bill being submitted and it passed and it's now law. In the aftermath, the board has been faced with navigating let's say an unhappy public that are shocked, you know, when they bring something to the board's attention, and the board's ability to investigate or how it's investigated is limited, and in some cases needing to be dismissed simply because of the statute and not up on the basis of the actual concern or violation. I would like to bring everybody's attention to the SB 1588, SB 1588, down where it says B as in boy in blue. The scope of an investigation pursuant to this section is limited to the information contained in the initial complaint or the information that the board has in its possession at the time of the board's motion to investigate. Okay, on its face, it may not seem like anything significant. However, it is. It's very significant. And we may have to be very proactive with our education and voicing our concerns, whether it be as a board with writing a letter or individually and getting associations involved. And here's why. You know, we have the similar verbiage within the rules for the other board that got enacted into law, and again, there's been some pretty significant fallout in just recent months alone. We've had 30 cases that had to be dismissed. As we know, especially very important with the health boards, is that when we receive a complaint and the investigation is launched, that oftentimes throughout the investigation, something new comes to light. You know, whether that be charting or conduct or whatever the case may be, right? Well, with regard to B there, okay, the language in B, that could put an immediate halt to the board's ability to do things and make, and when those discoveries are made, if they weren't articulated in the original complaint made by oftentimes a patient or a quote unquote layman, right, who may not understand the, you know, A to Z about a particular situation, or may be very brief in what they're focused on with regard to the complaint. If it's not written there, and if it's not known to the board when that complaint comes in, then it's off limits. And it's so important that the board and its members use their education and training in that same relevancy to pass on that important behavioral and professional change mandate to its physicians, with regard to how they document and conduct business and think about how they handle cases or patient complaints, that if we didn't have that ability, it would be a very significant disservice to the public, and a lot of things would go, you know, uninvestigated. And I think that that's a significant issue. And the fallout is, of course, bad on any board, but much more significant and serious on health boards. And so I think that it's really important that everybody take note to that and pay close attention before it becomes law, like we had happen with the other board.
It's a good point. How much, I guess, unless we're invited to make a comment or a statement, how much input does the board actually have, Casey or Gail, on these types of house bills?
You know, that's a really good question. And I don't know if Casey may help me with that. I don't know that the board has any input on these.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's left up to the individual associations or individual people that we regulate or not regulate to weigh in on this.
I have seen. So what some other boards do is they'll have the executive director or the deputy director, or sometimes even board members, provided that they're very clear that they're not speaking on behalf of the board, the members, I mean, and that they're just there in their own professional capacity, show up to committee hearings when these bills are being introduced or discussed. I don't know how to track that on the legislature's website when that happens. But executive directors will go there and testify. Oftentimes it's at the invitation of a legislator, but they certainly can go in, at least, and I haven't talked to Gail about this, so I don't know, but some other executive directors are the board's registered lobbyist, so they can go in and do that. So there is an opportunity to address the legislature when these bills come up.
Okay.
I don't know. There is a representative from the AZNMA on the line. I don't know if they plan on addressing this at all. Yes, Trace Lynn.
Yes, we are still formulating our position on that. But our lobbyist is aware, and we are having meetings on several bills, including that one.
Trisha, while you're on the line, I have a real quick question. It looks like you've tried like second or third time on the access naturopathic physicians.
Yes.
Has that made any progress? I mean, I've read that bill and it's still murky. Is that possibly going to go through, or is it going to be redrafted and rethought? Do you know?
We're hopeful it's going to move forward at this point. It's been heard in the House Health Committee, and it passed that committee by a vote of 7-5. And a couple of the legislators who were no votes have followed up with us and with Sonoran University of Health Sciences, because it was clear from the exchange during the hearing that they didn't have a lot of information on Sonoran and on, you know, the practice of naturopathic medicine in the state. So two of the no votes have followed up with Sonoran and are going to do, I think, a tour of the school, which is great.
Okay.
But I believe the next stop for that bill is House Rules Committee, and it wasn't scheduled for this week, but we're hoping it'll be heard next week.
And would that also entail the whole Medicaid portion of access?
This is on, I mean, access is Arizona's Medicaid program, and the way the bill is written, my understanding is it would cover naturopathic care under access. I believe right now we can provide care to minors in the access program, naturopathic physicians, but we're not approved for all access populations. And I believe this would extend availability of naturopathic care to all participants in the Arizona Medicaid program, but it would have to be approved. There's a contingency in there. It would have to be approved by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Yeah, because correct me if I'm wrong, isn't like 58% or whatever through the federal government and then 45-48% through the state?
I'm not sure the percentages, but, you know, there's Medicare, which is administered federally, and then there's Medicaid, which is administered at the state level. So I'm not sure of the percentages, but I believe adding naturopathic physicians as providers across the board under access does require approval of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Yeah, that's kind of what I thought.
Yeah, I believe so.
Well, we'll see. Probably be for the people that want to take that. That might be a good introduction for them. Any other questions on number 9? No? Okay. So we're through that. And then we have move on to number 10, future agenda items. So I think, do we have anything that was brought up that we want to discuss as a board in the future?
This Dr. Spatt, not exactly, but Dr. Campbell have an idea. I going to give the floor to Dr. Campbell regarding about merit of award for people on the board. Go ahead, Dr. Campbell.
Oh, thank you for that reminder. And actually, I did message Gail about it as well, and so we discussed it with regard to not only board members, but of course board employees too, for significant milestones and service recognition, and also, you know, if we have a board member that comes and they serve X amount of years, and then they leave the board in good standing, that, you know, that the board issue some type of plaque or letter that represents their service to the board and whatnot for their future use, etc. Do you recall that discussion, Gail?
Yes, I do. And just to bring the board up to speed, years ago we used to issue plaques and it became really expensive when we quit doing that. We can do that again if you want. I do like the idea of a recognition letter, and maybe, you know, the board can help sort of draft something like that. It could be signed by all the board members, if that were acceptable.
I wonder, yeah, I can imagine that, you know, especially depending on turnover, things can get costly with regard to that. I don't know exactly what those things cost. I know that the Board of Technical Registration, does the same thing. They will issue a plaque and letter. I don't know where they get their plaque from, or if there's a particular agency that has all the state of Arizona. Mm-hmm. Hallmarks and things like that, you know, and they might already be, have a set price or something that's a little bit more cost effective, because the state obviously probably orders a lot of things like that. You know, do you see that in the event we issued one or two of those, let's say a year, do you see that the board would have the funding for that? Or do you think that it would present an issue as far as like our petty cash or whatever, you know, whatever hypothetical we want to go with regard to, you know, I just, you know, to me, like for, you know, for instance, you know, when we have a board member leave, you know, and they've been, you know, with the board 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years, whatever the case may be, you know, something that they can, you know, put up on their wall, you know, or in their office, you know, that symbolizes the importance of service and their contribution to the state and their profession. You know, to me, that's something that is special and that people are going to really appreciate. And then also, you know, some of the other members in the past, I guess, have gone on to national boards or things like that. And so having the letter separately that they can, you know, copy, you know, as part of their CV will help that, you know, and then also, you know, be used as a verification so they don't have to reach back out to the board for some type of a letter in the event, you know, that they're applying somewhere and need that letter for whatever, you know, type of board or employment that they want to go for down the road. You know, and so it seems like people have just as a third, you know, wheel observer so far, that people have had good use for both of those, and shown their appreciation in different ways by having both of those when they leave the boards. And again, of course, just merely, a suggestion and seeing how everybody feels about that. And then we can go from there, I guess.
Well, and so what I can do is I can reach out to Judy, and see where she gets hers, and I can look at some other options perhaps and bring it back before the board, and give the board members options as to what they like and what you feel would be appropriate, and we could kind of go from there.
It's awesome to me.
Okay.
Yeah, I think Dr. Campbell's, because some of the people that have been on the board that left, I think it'd be a good idea for them to put on their CV. So if you can look into it, Gail, that might not be a bad way to pursue.
One Dr. Campbell talked to me about it. I was thinking of Mr. Chairman and the Vice Chairman as well, because you both have served on the board for quite a long time, and sincerely, I think you both did a really good job, and I really appreciate that.
Oh, thanks, Dr. Spad, and I appreciate.
Thanks, Doc.
We appreciate everybody here. It's a team effort to get through this.
Guys, one more thing, if you don't mind, yeah. And it's kind of awkward because like Gail, I know that you've served the state for a long time, and I don't know how often you guys get, you know, plaques or awards, you know, and, you know, hopefully you know how much the board appreciates you and your hard work and diligence. I don't know if the boards and commissions headquarters over at the, you know, Capitol, if they issue directors, you know, that kind of, you know, thing. I know that the larger boards that have, you know, directors, deputy directors, and sometimes very, you know, high numbers of staff, lots of people, that the director always takes care of everybody, you know, below them with regard to giving them certificates and things like that. But, you know, my question is, who gives the director, you know, a plaque or a certificate or something like that, you know, when they reach significant milestones, when, you know, they, you know, when they, if you want to give them some type of a, you know, kudos or whatever, who does that, you know, and if the, it would sound awkward for the board to say, you know, Gail, order yourself a plaque.
you just gave me a raise, so I'm really good at that.
But it still would be, you know, with regard to your career, I would like, as a board member, I would like to make sure that you do have things that you can appreciate down the road, because I think that really does matter. You know, when you retire and things like that, to see those things and be able to recollect on them and, that kind of thing, and know that, you know, that you were appreciated and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And so we'll definitely have to look into that too.
Thank you, Dr. Campbell. That's sweet.
Of course.
Thank you. You know how I feel about all of those things, right? So.
Appreciate it.
I think the reason these meetings really, in all honesty, flow so well is the amount of prep time Gail puts in, and then the information that, you know, we're able to share. Otherwise, these meetings wouldn't flow like they do. So as sharing the board, it's immensely helpful to have this organized the way it is. So thank you.
Yes.
I appreciate you guys. Thank you very much. That means a lot to me.
You bet.
Don't make me cry.
Hey, you know, you ate well, Gail. I just wanted to say that, okay?
Thank you, Dr. Spat. Well, this has turned awkward, so thanks, Dr. Campbell. No.
I know. Can't take me anywhere. Sorry.
Oh my goodness.
I'll roll on to 11, call to the public, and we'll do our, by the way, members, if you're bored, read that. There's a House bill about this if you get bored, but I'm going to do my 5-4-3-2-1 on call to the public.
Oh, hey, by the way, IFK Jr. Have been confirmed to be the new help.
Who's that? I didn't hear that.
IFK Jr. have been confirmed to head up the help the administration.
I don't know. Does anyone know?
Yeah, yeah. They just confirmed him.
Yeah, yes.
Oh, yes, I saw that.
HHS.
Cool.
But so sorry to interrupt you there, Mr. Chairman. Go ahead and do your countdown. I just want to give you an update on it.
Oh, thank you. Now, so to call the public, we'll do the 5-4-3-2-1. There is a House bill about this, but I won't get into that. And then let's go into adjournment. I appreciate everyone today. Good meeting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Take care.
Thank you. Have a good day. Bye-bye. Bye, thanks.